Welcome back to Microdigressions. This is Spencer Case. Belated Happy New Year. This is our first episode of 2022. And I'm thinking 2022 is going to be the year that takes microdigressions to the next level. Starting with things such as recording these intros separately and sort of giving an overview of the podcast before the interview begins. Something I'm going to start doing. And also, having more high-profile guests, including the guest for this episode, who is Jeff McMahon. Jeff McMahon is White's Professor of Moral Philosophy at Oxford. He's the author of many books, including The Ethics of Killing and Killing in War, which is, of course, going to be very relevant to today's episode. And he is also co-editor of the Journal of Controversial Ideas with Peter Singer and Francesca Minerva, who's also been a guest on this podcast. I've looked up to Professor McMahon for a long time, and I slipped into the dorky undergraduate mode and called him Professor McMahon near the end of the interview. So you can all laugh at what a transcendent dork I am. Okay. So I feel the need to give you a disclaimer about this episode. If you're not a philosopher, not very into philosophy, the second half of the conversation gets fairly abstract and gets into some pretty deep weeds in moral theory, and it's not going to be everybody's cup of tea. If discussing lots of cases and the difference between liability and the various forms of responsibility, if that doesn't sound exciting to you, you might want to pass this episode up. But if it sounds interesting to you, then you'll probably love this episode. I wanted to also correct a few things before this gets started. So the first is that I use the term soldier to refer to all combatants. That's using the term a bit loosely. Soldiers are people who fight in armies. So Marines, sailors, and airmen would not be soldiers. And neither would revolutionaries or Al-Qaeda terrorists and lots of other people. So I use soldier generically to just mean combatant. So just keep in mind that I'm using language kind of loosely there. Second, the conscientious objector to World War II, Franz Jägerstätter, is Austrian and not German. I think I spoke up to correct Jeff on that, but my mic was muted. So set the record straight now about that. And then finally, Jeff and I were talking about this case of a Nazi who was found out after many, many years. And so I found the details of that case. I wanted to report them to you because we weren't sure during the conversation. So the case is a case of Friedrich Karl Berger, and he was found to be, he was deported recently to Germany. I said he's going to spend the rest of his life in a prison cell, but I don't know if that's true. But it does seem very plausibly that that could be the outcome for him. Amazingly, indeed, as I said, the information that connected him to working in a concentration camp was found on an index card in a sunken submarine that had been down there for like 75 years. Which just imagine how unlikely that is, that not only does this card with this information survive that long, but then we find it and he's still alive to be prosecuted. It's a fairly astonishing sequence of events. This article also says, it's on CBS News and elsewhere, that he was still receiving a pension from Germany for his service in the war. What? That's almost as shocking as the thing about the index card. All right, so much for the intro. Let's get this thing going. Welcome to the podcast, Jeff McMahon. It's great to see you here.
Thanks, Spencer. Thanks for having me on.
I think I mentioned about a dozen years ago, I was a soldier in Afghanistan, and I read your book, Killing in War, on my Kindle, and I wrote you an email about it, about how impressed I was with it. But then I got nervous and I deleted the whole email. And then a decade later, somebody said, you know, you really ought to send that email. He would have appreciated hearing it.
I definitely would have. When you told me just now that you wrote an email, I became rather alarmed because I didn't remember receiving it. And I didn't want to be discourteous and say, oh, I'd totally forgotten that you wrote to me. I hope I replied. So I'm glad in a way to know that you didn't send it. But yeah, it would have given me quite a big boost to have received that from you. I wrote the book in the hope that it wouldn't just be a piece of philosophy that would be discussed only by philosophers, but would be something that would be read and discussed by officers in the military and others in the military, not just officers.
The topic of killing in war is sort of inherently interesting, but I'm still curious how it is that you came to work on this particular topic.
Well, there's a long history to my having worked on this topic. It begins with me in high school in the late 60s and early 70s during the Vietnam War and being highly sympathetic to the Vietnam War protesters. I can't say that I was terribly well informed. It sort of went being opposed to the war in Vietnam sort of went along with being a hippie at the time. And, you know, I was a kind of aspiring hippie. And I can't say that I had deep thoughts about it then. But, I grew up with a war going on and I was conscious of this. And then when I got to college, somehow or other, I became concerned about nuclear weapons and nuclear war. And I read some books about nuclear weapons, in particular, a couple of books by Bertrand Russell, which helped get me into philosophy because I was a major in English literature, not in philosophy. And then as time went on, I was concerned about American interventions in El Salvador and Nicaragua and elsewhere. I was highly sympathetic to the work of Noam Chomsky on, the exercise of American power in third world countries. And then I became very concerned about nuclear weapons again when Reagan was elected president. I was living in England at the time, in Oxford and in Cambridge, and the United States was wanting to deploy nuclear weapons in England and throughout Europe. And that phenomenon, the exacerbation of Cold War tensions under Reagan caused a lot of people to think carefully again about nuclear weapons. And philosophers had a rather vigorous debate in the early 1980s in particular about the ethics of nuclear deterrence. And I was a participant in that debate. And that prompted me to do some reading in just war literature, in particular, the bishops in different churches in the United States and elsewhere published statements about nuclear weapons and nuclear deterrence. There was a letter by the American Catholic bishops, and bishops in other churches produced similar documents. So there were formulations of and applications of traditional just war theory to nuclear weapons and nuclear war, nuclear deterrence. And I was a participant in that debate, in part because I was just really very alarmed about the threat of nuclear war, as were a lot of people, particularly in Europe at the time. And then through the 90s, there was the genocide in Rwanda, in which no one intervened. There were the nationalist wars in the Balkans, and that prompted some of us to continue thinking about the ethics of war. But I suppose the real resurgence of thinking about the ethics of war was prompted by the American wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And that's when I and other people started publishing more. I did publish a piece on the ethics of war in 1994 as a kind of companion piece to a paper I wrote on the ethics of self-defense. But at that time, nobody paid any attention to it. It was not a visible article, but it contained the core of the views that I subsequently developed when there was a much greater general interest, and in particular an interest among philosophers, in the ethics of war prompted by the two American wars in the Middle East. So that's really the evolution of my engagement with issues of the ethics of war. It's something I've always been concerned with, because war has been very present in the politics in the places where I have lived.
The aspect of your work that I was first familiar with, and what I know you most for in this area, is your critique of the doctrine of the moral equality of combatants. And I read your critique in Jim Skidmore's Philosophy of War and Terrorism class at Idaho State University, and I think 2007 or 2008. And it was one of the very few articles where, you know, I read it and I thought, yep, this settles that. It's a decisive refutation of the view. So I wanted to talk a bit about that doctrine and your criticism of it.
Well, good. Thank you. I'm delighted to hear that you had that response. I mean, I have to say, it always seemed kind of obvious to me, too. The moral equality of combatants is the view that was defended by Michael Walzer, that those combatants who fight in just wars in pursuit of aims that are just and legitimate, and those soldiers who fight in unjust wars in pursuit of aims that are wrongful and unjust, nevertheless have the same moral status, in that they have the same rights, the same permissions, and the same liabilities. There's no difference in their moral standing that derives from what the justice or injustice of the war in which they're participating. And both are equally capable of violating the rules of engagement in war. So there's a kind of perfect moral symmetry between soldiers who are fighting in just wars and soldiers who are fighting in unjust wars.
So, for example, an Allied soldier and an Axis soldier in World War II, neither of them does anything morally wrong in fighting in that war, despite the fact that the Axis powers were definitely on the unjust side of that war, provided that each of them obeys the laws of conduct within war. None of them line up civilians against walls and shoot them and that kind of thing. So long as they're playing by the rules within the war, their conduct isn't inherently unjust. They are, in that sense, moral equals.
That's right. And one of the objections that I have to the doctrine is that it forces us to accept that the rules of conduct in war are the same for people on both sides. But I think that's actually incoherent. That is to say, everybody in the just war tradition acknowledges a requirement of proportionality in the conduct of war. That's one of the rules of jus in bello. It's one of the rules governing the action of soldiers in war. And the idea behind the moral equality of combatants is that it's equally possible for combatants on both sides to act in accordance with these rules. But that can't be true of proportionality, which weighs good effects against bad effects. And if all the effects of an unjust combatant's action are bad, it can't possibly be proportionate. And, you know, that's true, for example, of the action of an Axis combatant in World War II. This person is going to be attacking and killing people who are engaged in justified self-defense against wrongful aggression, and those attacks are going to be instrumental in achieving aims that are bad, conquest of a country by a terrible dictator and leading to genocide or mass slaughter, whatever. There's simply no good effects of this soldier's action. And therefore, it can't possibly be proportionate in any coherent sense.
Perhaps a defender of the moral equality of combatants would say that the proportionality has to be understood relative to the military goal, not in terms of the total goodness of the effects or something like that.
That is what they say, but military advantage, which is the term that's typically used in orthodox formulations of the requirement of proportionality is not in itself good or bad. If it's military advantage for the Nazis, it's a bad thing. That is, you can't say that the killing of innocent civilians as a side effect in war can be weighed against military advantage for the Nazis and be proportionate, because there's just no measure of whether military advantage for the Nazis is good or bad apart from understanding what the effects of the military advantage actually are going to be.
I fully accept your logic there. And you bolster it with this domestic analogy involving self-defense, right? If you have two people and one of them attacks the other, he is compromised, at least compromised, his right to self-defense at that point. And so it seems like it's hard to see how he could respond proportionately.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I guess I would even say, and this is a more general point about the type of view that I have defended along with a number of other people, that the appeal to individual self-defense and defense of others isn't so much an analogy. It is actually foundational. My view is that we should think of the ethics of war as just a more complicated version of self and other defense. It's just self-defense or other defense involving more people. The principles are exactly the same. The principles that govern self-defense at the individual level and defense of others at the individual level, and the principles that govern both the initiation and conduct of war. They're the same principles. And that's one of the deep disagreements that I've had with the more traditional just war theorists, who think, no, there's one set of principles for individual action, and war is an entirely different phenomenon, and there are different moral principles that govern the morality of war. And I think, no, they're exactly the same.
Well, I want to play devil's advocate here. And one thing that occurs to me to say is, well, maybe there are institutional factors here that are not reducible to relationships between individual people. So consider the way the adversarial justice system works. You know, the defense lawyer, his job is to stand by his client within certain bounds, and the prosecutor is supposed to go after his client. And neither of them is aiming directly at justice here. Instead, they have a specific role to play in the system. And maybe it's the case that in a society that has other well-functioning institutions, this isn't going to be true for every society, but in a society with other well-functioning institutions, things just go better when there's a kind of moral separation of powers, so to speak, where the soldiers, they've got certain responsibilities, which is to follow legitimate orders. We can't have the army deciding when to invade or when not to invade. And then we leave that up to the politicians. So just as, you know, a defense lawyer, his job isn't the judge's job, you know, the soldier's job is not the job of the politician. So maybe there is something like that going on here.
Okay, that's a good point. What I think is, though, that there are really quite important differences. The adversarial system in the courts is intended to serve a particular epistemic function. We have to make a decision. So we want both sides of the issue to be stated as strongly as they possibly can, so that those who are going to make the decision have the most powerful case on both sides. And that's how the adversarial system works. It serves an epistemic purpose. Now, that's not the rationale for the division of labor about, like, the resort to war. We don't want the army deciding about the resort to war, because we want that decision to be made as democratically as possible. We want people who are elected officials to make those decisions. But we have to then consider different types of consequences when we say, no, politicians make these decisions and soldiers simply follow orders. What I think is that the consequences would be actually much, much better if we had a system in which soldiers were actually encouraged to think about the morality of the wars in which they are ordered to fight, and to refuse to fight when they genuinely believe, on the basis of real reflection and deliberation, that the war is one that is not morally justified. Soldiers, I think, always have a tendency to believe that their country must be in the right. We all have a certain amount of patriotism. It's hard to believe that we are the aggressors, that we are the evil ones. But in every case in which there is a side that is fighting unjustly, it is true that that country is in the wrong. We have a tendency to believe our own leaders and to dismiss the views of the leaders of our adversaries. We think our leaders must be right, their leaders must be wrong. So there is already an inbuilt disposition to believe that we're in the right. That needs to be counteracted, I think. If the prevailing view about the morality of war had been soldiers shouldn't just unquestioningly accept the judgments of their political leaders, but should think about what they're being asked to do and decide on the basis of serious moral deliberation what to do, then it would have been much more difficult for Hitler to invade all the various countries that the Germans invaded. And I think that would be really advantageous. Some people say, well, if you encourage soldiers to question the morality of what they're being ordered to do, then countries won't be able to fight just wars because soldiers will be resistant. But I don't think that that's the case for the reason I gave a moment ago. Most soldiers tend to believe that wars that are in fact unjust are just if it's their side that's fighting it.
So another way, I guess, to put the point is that what kind of error does it look like we're more prone to make here? Not fighting just wars or fighting ones that shouldn't be fought. And just a priori, you can think of some reasons why the second one would be more likely, which is that almost every war, and maybe absolutely every war, but almost all of them, there's at least one unjust side. And in many of them, there's going to be more than one unjust side. There could be wars in which nobody should be fighting this because it's a waste of blood and treasure over resources that don't matter to nearly enough extent to justify the bloodshed. So just that alone should make you think, okay, it seems like we're more prone to fighting unjust wars than to failing to fight just ones. Although I think there are examples of that. I think Hungary 1956, we should have intervened. I think Rwanda, we should have intervened. But I think there's a tendency to wage unjust wars that is the primary moral problem. And it's true that the military you would expect would be more biased in that direction than the rest of the country. So if the leaders can't sell the soldiers on the justice of the war, that's a pretty good indication that it isn't just.
I agree completely with everything you've just said. I think that's just exactly right. I don't have anything to add to that, really.
So let's consider then, the U.S. does allow a kind of conscientious objector exemption from the draft, but the courts have not allowed that to be interpreted as allowing somebody to be a conscientious objector to a particular war. So there was like the Gillette case with the Vietnam War and then the Aaron Watada case with regard to the Iraq War. And Watada was actually willing to serve in Afghanistan, but they wouldn't allow him to transfer into a unit that was in Afghanistan because his objection was specific to the Iraq War. And even when I was much more enthusiastic about those wars than I find myself now, it occurred to me that, well, if we're going to allow somebody an exception because they're just a general pacifist, it doesn't seem very reasonable to say that you can't have that opinion about a particular war, because thinking that some wars are unjust is a much more reasonable position than thinking all wars are unjust. And it just seems like the only reason that we have the conscientious objector rule and not the other rule is just that the leaders have realized there just aren't that many conscientious objectors we need to worry about.
Yeah, again, I just agree completely with everything you've said. I mean, I think pacifism is a morally mistaken position. And though, in a way, pacifists are, I think, admirable people, I think it's nevertheless a pernicious mistake. I've never met a pacifist I didn't like, but on the other hand, I just do think that it's definitely a bad view, and I've written about why. But selective conscientious objection is precisely what I think is morally required of people. It can be morally required to fight in a just war and morally prohibited to fight in an unjust war. And the legal apparatus should somehow or other be capable of recognizing that. One thing I'm told by people both in the American military, but particularly in the Israeli military, the IDF, that what happens informally on a lot of occasions is that soldiers who have moral qualms about certain missions, certain things, just get kind of transferred somewhere else where they don't have to do what they morally object to. And all of this is done sort of beneath the radar, behind the scenes, to avoid disruption of the harmonious working of things in the military. And that seems reasonable, but it shouldn't have to work in this kind of ad hoc way and depend just on the goodwill of intelligent officers who recognize, yes, this person is sincere and has legitimate concerns. So instead of getting this person into trouble and so on, let's just, you know, move him or her somewhere else. It'd be better if there were formal mechanisms for recognition of conscientious objection. And I should say that at least one person I knew who taught at West Point as an officer has published work defending not only selective conscientious objection among conscripts or people who are in the process of being conscripted, but also among active duty military personnel. So it's not a view that is unknown within the military.
Well, I don't know if I would sign on to what you said about you would want this to necessarily be formalized, because I sometimes think that the unspoken, informal ways we have of dealing with certain social problems are better than when they become legalistic. So I would want to know the specific nation and specifically how it's being applied and what the consequences are. But one immediate advantage I can see to it being formalized is that if it's all done under the radar, other soldiers don't hear about it, at least not soldiers outside of the unit. If it's above board, so to speak, then it can possibly cause other soldiers to reflect on their participation as well.
Yeah, this takes me back to something that we were both discussing earlier, and that is, I'm thinking in particular of something that you said, namely that if the soldiers are reluctant to fight a war and are giving moral reasons why they are reluctant to fight, that's a really good indication that the war is not morally defensible. And so what I have thought is that if active duty military personnel were given a kind of legal right of selective conscientious objection about wars in which they might be commanded to fight, this would actually better serve the interests of the states that these soldiers are supposed to be serving. It would serve as a constraint on a particular state's engaging in unjust wars. And that's good not just for the world at large, and not in particular, not good just for the state that would have been the victim of the unjust war, but it's better for the state itself not to fight unjust wars. We shouldn't want our own state to be fighting unjust wars. That's bad for the state itself and bad for the people. And any real patriot will resist having his or her country go into an unjust war. And having this further constraint imposed by the moral consciences of the soldiers themselves would, I think, be a good thing for everybody.
I wanted to talk now about the culpability of soldiers who participate in unjust wars. And I'm struck by the following juxtaposition, right? Like, think about a soldier in the German army who becomes a prisoner of war in the US and then is freed and becomes an American. I've heard stories of this happening, like German POWs marrying American women and basically becoming normal Americans after that. People are pretty much willing to say, I mean, I'm sure they were hard feelings about some of these things, but people are pretty much willing to say, well, it was in the war and a lot of bad stuff happens in war and it's water under the bridge, more or less. At least decades later, it's water under the bridge. But consider our attitude toward anyone involved in the actual carrying out of the Holocaust. I read an article recently about this old German guy who was long suspected of having been a guard in one of the concentration camps, and he denied it his whole life. But they actually found proof that he was one in a sunken submarine. They found a card inside the submarine that identified him as a guard in one of the concentration camps. So incredibly unlucky, you almost feel bad for the guy, but not quite. There's probably not much left of his life, but he's going to spend the rest of it inside of a prison cell. And so it seems like there's a really big difference in how we view ex-unjust soldiers, you know, those who fought on the unjust side of the war, and people who were involved with genocides. But if your view is right, it's not clear that there's such a sharp distinction between the two, right?
I think as a general proposition, that may well be right, but let me make this distinction. You're citing someone who was a guard at a concentration camp, and we want to compare that person with a Nazi soldier who is actually out in combat fighting uniformed personnel on the other side. It's much easier for a person to believe that what he or she is doing is morally justified if the people that that person is attacking in war are armed and attacking that person and his or her comrades. It's much easier to believe that what one is doing is justified in that kind of situation than it is to believe that what one is doing working in a guard tower at a concentration camp in which there are just civilians who are being either made to work or exterminated or whatever's going on at the concentration camp. It's not very hard to tell that what you're doing when you're serving that kind of function is wrong. I remember a number of years ago, a case of the sort that you mentioned, was the man's name Demenyuk? Demenyuk or something like that, an American guy?
I don't recall.
Yeah, I think it was some guy around the Chicago area with a sort of Polish-type name. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But soldiers who deliberately attack civilians who are just ordinary civilians and not, for example, working in armament factories or weapons laboratories or something like that, but are just people leading ordinary lives, it's not very hard for those people who are doing this to know that what they are doing is wrong, even if they are acting under orders. And so I think we can draw a general distinction between combatants who are deployed in real combat and people who are SS officers rounding up civilian populations and taking them out and shooting them and putting the bodies into a ditch and burying them, or guards in concentration camps who are overseeing the tormenting and killing of civilians in this way for no recognizable purpose other than genocide and benefiting the side who's exploiting these people, for example, for forced labor or whatever.
Yeah, so the suggestion would be inherently what they're doing isn't that different, but it might be more excused. There might be more excuses that apply to them.
Exactly. Yeah, thank you for putting it that way. Yeah, that's the point I would make about the doctrine of the moral equality of combatants, that what Walzer and other people took to be conditions of justification for what soldiers who are fighting in an unjust war are doing are actually conditions of excuse or mitigation, not justification. And it's very difficult to find excusing conditions or mitigating conditions for people who are serving as guards and slave masters in concentration camps.
Well, how about this for an excusing condition? They were incredibly indoctrinated and deceived by their leaders. That seems like it's at least partly an excuse.
Yeah, I think it is. But it's a very partial excuse when what you're doing is beating or killing people who've been forcibly evacuated from their homes, who were doing nothing but living ordinary lives before the thing happened. So it's still incredible to think what kind of indoctrination could have succeeded in making a person believe that Poles or Jews or Roma people as a people have to be exploited, exterminated, whatever. How could you believe that? I mean,
but they did, right? I mean, there were true believers to these things.
Yeah, but I think we have to distinguish between claims that are in some way genuinely plausible to a reasonable person and claims that simply coincide with prejudices and biases and unjustifiable hatreds that people already have. We should all be aware of our tendency to want to believe the worst about people that for some reason or other we dislike. And I think that's what happens in these cases. We are easily deceived into believing the worst about people we're already predisposed to dislike because they disagree with us about something, or because we don't like the color of their skin or something of that sort. We should be able to recognize these prejudices in ourselves.
I mean, I guess what I'm getting at here is, yes, they're culpable. And part of their culpability is a culpability of a failure of intellectual ethics. They should have thought about this, what they were being told, more critically. But the same could be said for soldiers who are invading another country. I'm just not seeing anything that points to the gulf of difference in how we feel about these two groups of people. It seems to me that one of the really significant moral upshots of rejecting the moral equality of combatants is that there isn't so much a difference between people who participate in genocides and people who participate in wars. And the suggestion is that the excusing conditions are different for each. There's greater excuses for the soldiers. And I guess I'm not totally convinced of that, because it's just hard for me to know what kind of indoctrination people will be susceptible to. It's hard for me to put myself in the shoes of somebody who's been fed this kind of stuff. And so to know the extent of the intellectual failure in each group, and to be so certain that it's so much different for the soldier than the person in the concentration camp, I'm just less confident about that.
Okay, I see your point, and I think it's a good point. And these claims about excusing conditions are all matters of degree. But here are a few considerations that I think do support a pretty substantial asymmetry between unjust combatants, that is, people who are fighting in combat in an unjust war, and concentration camp guards and personnel on the other. One is that, as I said earlier, the combatants can see what they're doing as in some way defensive, both defensive of themselves, of their fellow soldiers, and possibly in support of goals that are justified. And soldiers are usually convinced that they're doing something that is morally required of them for the sake of their country. Less easy to see what one is doing in a concentration camp as in any way defensive. These people are already captured and they're being forced to work. They're being treated very cruelly and so on. If you read the memoirs of people who were in the German concentration camps, almost nothing is said about any of the people employed in these camps being in any way kindly or gentle or whatever with the people. There was sort of a pervasive cruelty among these guards. So that's another thing. Soldiers who are fighting in a war, they are supposed to be governed by a constraint of necessity, which in the conduct of war can be understood as a requirement of minimal force or a requirement not to cause any unnecessary suffering or a superfluous injury or whatever. Part of their code is don't harm the enemy soldier any more than is necessary to achieve the aims of the military goals. But the ethos in the camps was treat these people as vermin and show no mercy, no pity, no sympathy. And like I say, the memoirs tend to substantiate that claim. So that's another difference. So I've suggested one, in the concentration camps, people can't really believe that what they're doing serves any kind of defensive purpose. Making these people do work and so on isn't defensive. There was kind of pervasive cruelty in the camps, which was explicitly supposed to be disallowed in the combat operations. And finally, part of the problem is the pernicious influence of the doctrine of the moral equality of combatants. That is, one excusing condition for soldiers fighting in an unjust war is that everybody has always believed that it is not immoral to fight in an unjust war. There is no moral equality between soldiers and concentration camp guards. So that's another important excusing condition for the combatants that doesn't apply to the personnel in a concentration camp or participant in genocide who's killing civilians. There's never been a doctrine that says, you know, moral equality of combatants who fight soldiers and armed military personnel who just go around massacring civilians.
So if I can encapsulate where I think we've arrived here, genocide participant and the unjust warrior, they're both indoctrinated, but the kind of indoctrination that the warriors are subject to is one that has a kind of more inherent credibility to it. So it's a lesser degree of a failing of intellectual ethics and thereby more excused.
Precisely. Yeah, that sums it up perfectly.
So with that in mind, I was thinking about demandingness. And it seems like there are certain things where morally you shouldn't do them even at the cost of your own life. And I think participating in a genocide, even at a low level, such as being on a guard tower, is one of those things. Better to give up your life than to be involved with something like that. I think you're probably committed to saying the same thing about participating as an unjust warrior, because although it's more excused, excuses don't change the wrongness of what you're doing. If you know that it's wrong, the fact that it will be a partially excused wrong does not mean that it isn't wrong, and doesn't mean that it isn't even wrong objectively to the same degree as the other thing I was mentioning. So if you know that the war is unjust and you go along with it anyway, that really does seem comparable.
Well, there are varying degrees of participation in an unjust war. And I do think that one ought to allow oneself to be killed rather than oneself kill an innocent person. But that's consistent with going ahead and serving in an unjust military operation in the following way. You can get your gun and you go out with your comrades in arms and you risk your life, but you don't actually shoot anybody on the other side. You aim into the ground, you fire over their heads, whatever.
Which many did.
Yeah, and I think people who do that are actually not liable to be killed by the people on the just side. But of course, the soldiers on the just side can't discriminate or distinguish between those who really pose a threat and those who don't. So I do think that the right thing to do in those circumstances is, or at least it's perfectly permissible to go out and be among unjust combatants, but not actually do anything that supports the pursuit of the unjust goals of the war, and in particular, doesn't involve harming any of the people on the just side. That in itself, a combatant's taking great risks, because there the person is in combat, unwilling to shoot the people who might shoot him or her. But that might be a lesser risk than saying to the commanding officer, I refuse to fight. Because in some cases, the commanding officer will just shoot you on the spot if you say that. That was done even to British troops in World War I, and not just to Nazis who refused to fight. In my book, Killing in War, I cite the example of Franz Jägerstätter. I'm not able to pronounce his name properly, but he was a farmer in Germany who refused to fight in the Second World War because he believed it was an unjust war. And I think he was eventually beheaded. Certainly he was executed in the end. Yeah, I don't think one has to go to that extreme. That's the best thing to do, because you openly register your protest and you openly declare that the war is unjust and people know about it. I mean, one of the things I may have pointed out in the book, I can't remember, but certainly that I learned when I read about Jägerstätter was that he was visited in his jail cell before he was executed by a number of Catholic clergy and someone who came along and told him, do go ahead and fight. It's okay. You know, we don't want to see you executed and so on. And so they knew those bishops or whoever they were who came to visit him to try to persuade him to go ahead and fight, they had to know that he was better than they were. And he was letting them know that. And that's an admirable thing to do. That's why if there's a hero of my book, he's it.
I don't know if you saw the recent movie about him, A Hidden Life.
No, I don't watch movies, so I don't even know about it.
Well, it's quite a good movie about it. According to the movie, he was even given the option of serving in a hospital, provided he took the oath to Hitler, and he refused that even.
I don't remember that, but that sounds entirely plausible to me. Some years ago, I made a pilgrimage with a good friend of mine, Bernard Koch, who lives in Bad Tölz in the south of Bavaria. We went east and visited Jägerstätter's house and his grave in the little church there near his house by way of honoring him. What a noble person he was. His wife lived, I think, almost into the 21st century. She lived into her 90s.
I didn't realize that. One of the things I took away from watching the movie was that just the social pressure alone was so immense that once you have a person who's able to resist the kind of social pressure, it's really not surprising that he'd be willing to go to the gallows for what he believes. It really isn't that much harder.
Yeah, what you're saying is reminding me of a passage in Tim O'Brien's book, The Things They Carried, in which O'Brien says it took much less courage to go and expose yourself to death in Vietnam than it took to stay in your hometown as a conscientious objector and be vilified by all those you grew up with and your parents and so on. It took a lot less courage to go all the way to Vietnam and expose yourself to gunfire, which impressed me because it made me realize how much more rare moral courage is than physical courage.
It does seem to me, though, that you are committed to saying that if you know that your side is on the unjust side and you enlist and decide to go along with it, you don't do what Jägerstätter does. He's like, okay, I'll enlist, but I'm not going to kill anyone. And you happen to find yourself in a trench with an enemy soldier with a bayonet, and it's you or him. You're not allowed to defend yourself in that case.
Yeah, that's my view. I mean, you're allowed to defend yourself if you can defend yourself without killing or gravely harming the combatant on the just side, then that's acceptable. If you can persuade this person, hey, wait a minute, I'm firing over people's heads, I'm not really a threat. But of course, you can't do that. But if you could somehow disable this person to save yourself, that would be okay. But yes, I think it would be impermissible to kill this soldier to save oneself. I think it would also be impermissible to kill this soldier to save one's good friend. I think that one could do more harm to the just combatant to save one's friend than one could do to save oneself. But I find that the claim that I've made, to which people I know have put up the most resistance, is the idea that one mustn't kill the just combatant in order to save the life of one's friend and fellow soldier. But I think that's true too.
Yeah, that's a hard thing to accept, but I can see the reasoning behind it. I wanted to move on then and talk about your positive view. So you have this idea that unjust combatants become liable to be targeted in a way that just combatants don't. Could you talk a little bit about liability to be targeted?
Well, the view I have defended is that the basis of liability to defensive harming is moral responsibility for a threat of wrongful harm to others. And that's because if one is morally responsible for a threat of harm to other people, one has acted in a way for which one is responsible that has made it inevitable or unavoidable that someone has to be harmed. And as a matter of justice, the person who has made this unavoidable through his own responsible action is the one who should suffer the harm that he himself has made unavoidable. So that's the basic idea. Of course, a lot depends on what the bases of moral responsibility are. And what I have argued implies also that if one is morally responsible for some threatened harm, one is also causally responsible for that threatened harm. But as I have pointed out in earlier work and others have discussed in greater detail and in better ways than I did, there can be cases in which a person is not causally responsible for a threat, but nevertheless seems to be liable to be harmed as a means or side effect of the elimination of that effect. Another way in which I have changed my view is this. I think it's really a change in view about moral responsibility, and that is, suppose that I am epistemically justified in believing that I am morally required to attack some person who turns out to be entirely innocent. That is to say, I am mistaken about this, and yet I'm epistemically justified. That is, I can't know better. And my belief is that I'm morally required. That is, it's not optional for me to attack this person. And I reasonably believe this, but mistakenly. Now, I believe that in those circumstances, a person does not make him or herself liable to attack, even though that person is responsible for a threat of wrongful harm. So that's, again, an exception to the view that I stated in the book.
Suppose we've got a case like that. When you're home and you think that I'm an intruder, but I'm not. You're expecting me on a particular day and there was a mix-up of the days. And so now you think I'm a hostile intruder and you're going to kill me. And the only way I can stop this from happening is killing you, but you're not liable to be attacked because you're epistemically justified. So I wouldn't be able to do that then on your view.
Well, you might, but you'd need a different form of justification from a liability justification. Now, let me add a bit of detail to your example to make my view appropriately credible. If you're at home alone and this intruder comes in, your justification for engaging in self-defense doesn't rise to the level of requirement. You are not morally required to defend yourself. You're taking a gamble when you attack me. Let's suppose I'm the intruder now. I enter your home. I'm there at your invitation, but you're justified in having forgotten this or whatever. If you're there alone and you attack me in what you believe to be justified self-defense, and what you reasonably believe to be justified self-defense, that's not an instance of the kind of phenomenon I was calling attention to because you're not morally required to defend yourself. But suppose your children are cowering in a back room. You've sent them back there, you know, to keep them safe from this intruder, and you reasonably believe, you justifiably believe that I threaten the lives of your children. Now you are morally required. You are justified in believing that you're morally required to attack me. In that case, I think you are not liable. Therefore, if I have a justification for attacking you, it can't be a liability justification. And that's one of those cases in which I might have to allow myself to be killed rather than unjustifiably kill you. And it's all a colossal misunderstanding.
I thought liability was like an umbrella for all of the kinds of justifications there would be, not a specific kind of justification.
Oh, well, there can be a variety of forms of justification for harming a person. One is a liability justification, that is, the person has done something that has stripped that person of the right not to be harmed by somebody for a particular reason. There could also be a desert-based justification for harming somebody, namely the person has done something that makes him deserve the harm. There can be a lesser evil justification for harming somebody who's entirely innocent, and that is that the harm to this innocent person is justified as a means or side effect of preventing a much greater harm to other innocent people. In that case, one does wrong the victim. One does infringe the rights of that person, but the person's rights are kind of overridden by the conditions. And there can also be what might be called a greater good justification, which is just that sometimes it can be permissible to harm an innocent person as a means or side effect of providing very, very great benefits to other people. That's a rarer kind of thing, but it can occur. So a liability justification for harming a person is only one of a number of types of justification for harming, but it is typically the only justification for defensive harming, in my view.
I think I have an extension of your view that you're going to want to resist. Hear this out. So one of the features of your view is that the degree of culpability can be relevant to the kind of force that is made in response, like correct, like the more culpable I am, the greater harm you're allowed to inflict on me in self-defense. Is that right?
Yeah, there are at least two factors that determine the amount of harm to which a threatening person is liable. One is the magnitude of the harm that the threatening person threatens to cause to others, and the other is the degree of responsibility or culpability of the threatener. Those two factors combine to determine the amount of harm to which a person can be liable.
So I'm wondering what you would say to this then. So you talk about soldiers who are fully culpable, and I thought about that and I thought, fully culpable, is there an upward bound on how culpable someone can be? Because it seems to me I can think of certain kinds of agents, extra culpables, you might call them, who do things that are like just demonically evil, like worse than even what you would call a fully unjustified or fully culpable soldier. So I have in mind Hitler's SS, the kill militias in the Rwandan genocide, and al-Qaeda in Iraq, aka ISIS, the kinds of stuff they were doing. Those people are really, really culpable. They're culpable in the way that the Holocaust participant is culpable. And I wonder what you say to this. Could it be the case that we would be allowed to use weapons against these kind of culpable agents that we wouldn't be able to use against ordinary culpable agents, not in a retributive sort of sense, not to inflict as much suffering as we can on them. I don't endorse retributivism, although I have those intuitions, try to hold them at arm's length. But I have to say, I'm highly unsympathetic to such people and don't particularly mind if the most effective way of repelling the threat involves inflicting a whole lot of suffering on them. So using poison gas or white phosphorus or bombs with glass shrapnel and this kind of stuff, really, really nasty weapons. Ordinarily, it wouldn't be justified even against fully culpable soldiers. But since we're fighting against these extremely culpable agents, maybe we have permission to use such weapons that would ordinarily be forbidden. What do you think about that?
I agree with you. The crucial part of your stipulation, though, was one could defend oneself against these people more effectively by using the weapons that cause great suffering. That's important. In that case, it wouldn't be unnecessary suffering or gratuitous or superfluous injury, the terms that are used in the law. These forms of weaponry would actually be necessary in the sense that they would be more effective. And if these are these very, very highly culpable people, I can't see that they could possibly claim, no, you're wrong to use these weapons that cause additional suffering. You're permitted to attack us only with the weapons that you would be permitted to use against others. I don't see that they could have any such complaint given the kind of behavior that they are engaged in, the kinds of action that you described of participants in genocide and that sort of thing.
Wow. I am surprised you're willing to bite that bullet. I thought you'd see this as a reductio.
Why should innocent people accept further risks to themselves, or why should they accept further risk to other innocent people to spare these really very evil people some additional suffering? I don't see that as a bullet to bite. It's not retributivist. So I'm with you. Your description of yourself describes me in exactly the same way. I do have retributive intuitions and retributive impulses in a way that, for example, my old supervisor, Derek Parfit, simply didn't. I do have those. And I do have some sympathies with retributivism, but not enough to endorse it. So I've always wanted to ground my own claims about permissible harming of others in liability terms rather than terms of desert. So I think we're in agreement there. But as I say, it seems to me that this is something these people make themselves liable to. And I can't imagine they're having any justified complaint. And that in itself is one test of whether we think that they are liable to this. Could they really justifiably complain about being subjected to this additional suffering, given what they're doing? No.
Very interesting. So you used to have the view that it was culpability that makes one liable to harm. But now you've got something that's sort of intermediate between being culpable and just being a threat. You've got being responsible, agent responsibility for the threat.
Yeah.
Could you tell me about that distinction between agent responsibility and culpability?
Yeah, the example that I give, I think, in the book is the conscientious driver. There are people who knowingly engage in forms of action that, in fact, are permissible, at least in the evidence relative sense. That is, given all the evidence they have, these people are acting permissibly. So they're not acting culpably, but they know that their action does carry the risk of harm to others. And my view is, if the risk of that harm is realized, and so they've actually now created a threat of harm, and somebody's got to be harmed, I think they are liable to be harmed rather than somebody who hasn't made such a choice. So they're not culpable because we've stipulated that they're acting in a way that, given all their evidence, is permissible. Nonetheless, they've made a choice to create this risk, and that grounds their liability. So I would say they are responsible for the threat that they have posed, or the threat they pose. They're not culpable for posing that threat, but the mere responsibility alone is enough to make them liable, subject to relevant proportionality constraints and so on. And I think the proportionality constraint on attacking somebody who is merely responsible for a threat but not culpable is more stringent than the proportionality constraint on defensively attacking somebody who is acting culpably. So that's the point about proportionality varying with the degree of a person's responsibility for the threat.
That seems like a form of moral luck, right? Like, it's not moral luck if moral luck involves culpability, but this isn't luck with regard to culpability, but it's with regard to this other thing.
Yes, this is an instance of moral bad luck. I thought it also coincides quite nicely with Bernard Williams's notion of agent regret. So there's Bernard gives this example of a truck driver who's driving along and a child darts out into the street. He runs over the child. He's not in any way at fault, couldn't brake, but still feels something that shouldn't be moral guilt, but is a special form of regret. And I think that special form of regret is rational when the person is responsible in the sense of having made a choice that, in effect, exposed this child to risk.
I wonder, though, if there's a part of your theory that doesn't capture this so neatly, right? Like, because you distinguish between the one driver with the freak accident and then the ambulance case. Could you give me those cases again, and then I'll explain my point?
Okay, well, it may well be. I think I've changed my view about the ambulance driver. What I think in that case is the ambulance driver may be someone who matches the description I gave a little bit earlier of the person who is acting on the basis of a justified belief that what he or she is doing is morally required, and that exempts that person from liability. So let me explain the cases just to give your listeners the background. My example of the conscientious driver is somebody who drives for a reason of self-interest, going to the cinema or to the grocery store or something like that, who keeps the car well-maintained and drives carefully, but nevertheless, there's some oil on the road or whatever, and the car slides off the road and is going to kill somebody who's off the road having a picnic or something like that. And the question is it permissible for somebody to blow up this car to prevent it from running over the innocent person off the side of the road who's having the picnic? And my claim is yes, that the conscientious driver is not in any way culpable, but has made himself liable by choosing to drive. The ambulance driver is in exactly the same situation, driving the ambulance with somebody taking them to the hospital. Car goes off the road. Would it be permissible to kill the driver to prevent the ambulance from running over an innocent person where this wouldn't harm anybody else? I suppose, you know, the person in the back of the ambulance is still going to get to the hospital in time and so on and so forth. And what I think now is that it may be reasonable for the ambulance driver to believe that what she's doing in driving the ambulance to the hospital is morally required of her. Of course, in fact, it's not morally required, given that she's going to run over this innocent person on the way there. So she's making this mistake, but she's justified in believing that what she's doing is morally required. And that, on the view that I hold now, exempts her from liability.
So she's exempt from liability, but wouldn't she still feel agent regret if she ran over the kid?
Yes, she would. Good. Good point. I need to think about this. I think she's in a morally a different position from that of the truck driver who runs over the child, when it was not possible for the truck driver to avoid that, given that the truck driver had decided to drive the truck. So I think I really am committed to saying that the ambulance driver should feel something different from what the truck driver feels. At least there's this difference. There should be a difference in the content of the thought that goes with whatever the emotion is that they have. So the truck driver will have to think, I wish I had never got in my truck this morning. I wish I had taken a different route or whatever. I'm sorry that I drove. Can the ambulance driver have that same thought, given that she needed to get somebody urgently to the hospital, perhaps to save that person's life? There's got to be some difference in the content of the thought that goes along with the feeling of regret. So I'd still want to differentiate between the cases, but I'm not sure exactly how to do it. And it's, again, a subtle difference. And Williams's notion of agent regret is not terribly precise in its application in any case.
One thing I wondered when I was reading these cases is it seemed to me that there was a really sharp distinction between moral and prudential reasons, at least in the way the cases are presented. It sort of came across this way. So like the ambulance driver, sure, this person has got a moral reason to be driving this ambulance. But the conscientious driver, what might she be doing? Well, the example isn't filled out, but it might be something like going to the store to get food for her family, which is not a hugely praiseworthy moral thing, or even going to the gym to get fit and take care of her body. I think you can have more responsibility to care for yourself. So I tend to think that lots of things that are often thought of as just prudential reasons have a moral aspect to them. So I guess that leads me to think that the difference between the two is maybe less than you think. It's not like one of them is doing something that's just a permissible thing, and one of them is doing something that's like a moral thing. In an ordinary case, it's easy to imagine that the conscientious driver could be doing something that she has an imperfect duty to fulfill, even if she's just going about her daily business, because you really have reasons to go about your daily business.
An excellent thought. I think that's a powerful challenge to the idea that there's a sharp distinction here between people who have reasons of self-interest to drive and those like an ambulance driver who's morally required to drive. So yeah, I didn't fill out the example when I gave it in the book or in other, I think when I've stated the case subsequently, I altered it in a couple of ways. I think maybe I stipulated that the driver was driving for a reason that's clearly morally optional, like going to the cinema, you know, to watch a movie. And I also changed it so that the person threatened by the car that goes off the road is not somebody who's just walking on the sidewalk right next to the road, because people have said, well, that person is assuming a risk by getting, you know, close to the road. So I made it somebody having a picnic well off the road, where there doesn't seem to be any obvious assumption of risk. But what you're challenging me to do, though, is to consider not the sharp distinction between the ambulance driver who's got to get somebody to the hospital or the person in the back is going to die, and the person who drives for a reason that's essentially frivolous, say to go to the movies, but somebody who's going, as I myself suggested, to the grocery store to get food. If she doesn't live within walking distance of the store, then it's, you know, it is morally imperative that at some point she get food in for herself and in particular for her family. And so that's a kind of intermediate case. And that challenges the distinction I'm drawing here. What I was suggesting is there is a distinction between the ambulance driver who is non-liable because acting on the basis of a reasonably perceived moral requirement, and the conscientious driver who's acting permissibly, but in no way reasonably believes that what he's doing is something that he's morally required to do. And you're giving me an intermediate case. And there doesn't seem to be anything that is intermediate between liable and non-liable. So I've got to put this person in one basket or the other. That is the person who's driving to the grocery store and can't get food otherwise. And I'm not sure what to say about that.
Is it not possible to have a scalar view of liability?
Where the scalar element to liability arises is in the degree of harm to which a person is liable. So I've for a long time thought that one shouldn't refer to degrees of liability. One should instead refer to degrees of harm to which one is liable. And yeah, I think you could say perhaps that the person who drives to get to the grocery store to get food might be liable, but liable to a lesser degree of harm, just given the necessity of driving to the store at some point. But if that's really a moral necessity, got to feed the children, then it does look like it's got to go on the side of the ambulance driver, the non-liability side. I mean, there is this difference, but it's hard to see how it's relevant. And that is that it's never morally necessary for the person who's going to the grocery store to go at a particular time. It is morally necessary for the ambulance driver to go at a particular time. You know, this particular act of the ambulance driver, that is taking this particular person to the hospital, is justifiably believed by the ambulance driver to be morally necessary. That particular act. Whereas that's not true in the case of the parent who goes to the grocery store to get food for the family.
Maybe this is relevant, because if the ambulance driver doesn't drive the ambulance, he does something wrong, period. If this person doesn't go to the store right now, she doesn't do anything wrong. She has some agency to pick the manner of the carrying out of the imperfect duty. And maybe that agency in how to carry out your imperfect duty introduces some more luck into the situation.
Yeah, it was something like that that I was trying to get at by saying that the person who's got to drive to the grocery store to get food doesn't have to drive on any particular occasion. I was presupposing, however, that there's no other way that this person can get food for the children other than driving. So the type of act, driving to the grocery store, is morally required at some point, just not on any particular occasion. But how could we expect that person to drive on an occasion when the road isn't going to be slippery or something like that, where right. I'm assuming that the slipperiness of the road is not something that it's possible to predict or anticipate in any way. It's not like it's an icy day.
Now, this leads me to another point I'm sort of puzzling over, and not just in your work, this shows up in other people's work too, is the sense when you talk about something being objectively morally wrong. So I'm a moral realist, so I believe that there are acts that are objectively morally wrong in the sense that they would be wrong even if everybody in the world believed they were right and had a certain attitude toward them or what have you. But you have this sense of objectively wrong that is different than that. For example, in your conscientious driver case, I think what you say that what the person does is objectively unjustified. Is that right?
I'll explain why. It's just that the objective condition is that there's oil on the road around this curve. If the person knew that fact in advance, that if you drive on this road at this time, your car is going to go off the road and there's going to be a picnicker that you're going to run over, then you'd realize it is objectively wrong to drive at that time, whatever the aim is. So it's permissible in the evidence relative sense, but objectively wrong, meaning wrong in what Parfit calls the fact relative sense.
It seems to me that what we should say is, if I knew about this and still decided to drive, then I would be doing something wrong. That's clear. But to say that my action in the actual world in which I don't know this is objectively morally wrong just strikes me as puzzling. It seems like this outcome is unfortunate, but I'm not inclined to see that as a moral appraisal given my ignorance of the facts. So I guess this notion of objective morally wrong is puzzling because I just want to cash it out in terms of, no, there's nothing wrong about my action. It's an unfortunate outcome. But if I would have known and acted the same way, that would be unjustifiable.
Okay, I don't think there's any substantive difference between us here. I'm appealing here to the distinction that was drawn less sharply in the past between subjective wrongness and objective wrongness. And you find those terms in the legal literature as well. But I think Parfit expanded the categories and defined them a bit more sharply when he introduced his distinctions between wrong in the belief relative sense, wrong in the evidence relative sense, and wrong in the fact relative sense. And in the case of the conscientious driver, what the conscientious driver does is permissible in the belief relative sense, namely, she believes that what she's doing isn't going to cause any harm. So relative to her belief, what she's doing is permissible. It's also permissible in the evidence relative sense because relative to her evidence, there's no reason for her not to drive. She doesn't know that the oil slick is there on the road around the corner where she won't be able to see it before she hits it. So I agree with Parfit. All three of these notions are coherent. They just describe different types of permissibility or wrongness. It's compatible with moral realism to say she's acting permissibly in the evidence relative sense, and it's compatible with moral realism to say she's acting impermissibly in the fact relative sense.
I'm not questioning the compatibility of with moral realism so much. I'm just, there's something about it that I balk when morally wrong in the objective or the fact relative sense. That doesn't seem like a real moral category to me. That seems like just an evaluative category, like it's unfortunate. And if you knew about it, then a moral category would be applied to the action.
Would you be satisfied by the claim that when the conscientious driver drives her car conscientiously, skids off the road and kills the person having a picnic, we would say that what she has done is wrong in the sense that if anybody had done this knowing that this was going to be the consequence, they would have been, you know, highly culpable. She, however, hasn't done anything culpable. We don't blame her in the slightest because she didn't know and couldn't know. Nevertheless, in, you know, relative to what the facts were, she's done something that's wrong. Namely, she's driven her car and killed somebody. You know, killing an innocent person is just something that is wrong, even if it's done excusably, where the excuse is an epistemic excuse. All the evidence suggested that she was going to be able to drive without harming anybody.
I'm still hung up on it, I'm afraid.
Are you hung up on it because you think that to say that an act is wrong involves some kind of condemnation of the person who did it? But that's what we have the notion of an excuse for. There are cases in which people act, and I mean, you can see it more clearly, let's say, in the law. A person acts, does violate the law, no question about it, but they had excusing conditions and therefore is not guilty, or at least is fully excused and therefore not punishable, but still did something that was illegal. And so I'm just saying we have the same thing in morality. You can do what's wrong and be fully excused, but it's wrong only in the fact relative sense and permissible or praiseworthy or whatever in the evidence relative sense. And as long as we have the relevant vocabulary, the necessary vocabulary, there's no confusion here. And I think the source of your reluctance to accept this is just that you probably think that to say that somebody acted wrongly implies some element of blame or something of that sort, but it needn't.
Yeah, I guess it seems strange when the evaluation of the act is so detached from the agent that it seems like what you're really evaluating is an event. It's an evaluative claim. It's not a moral claim. That's kind of where my intuitions are with it.
Well, why not just say that it's a moral evaluation? It's a moral evaluation of an act. This is an act of a kind that is wrong. Running over an innocent person in your car or driving when it's inevitably going to involve running over a person with your car.
The case is underdescribed. I need to know something about the agent's state of mind before I can assign it a moral category. That's, I guess, my intuition. But it sounded like you were saying you think the disagreement here is not a substantive one.
I really think the disagreement here is not substantive at all. It's just a disagreement about the way in which we're going to use words like morally wrong.
I think those are the main questions I had for you with regard to the ethics of war. And we've got a few minutes left before I said I'd for sure let you go. And I didn't know what you wanted to talk about next, like JCI or nuclear war or whatever you'd like.
Well, why don't we talk just briefly about the Journal of Controversial Ideas? That's something in which we are both interested.
I read with great interest and wrote about the first issue, and I've been awaiting the second. And is that forthcoming?
Yes, it is forthcoming. We haven't filled the second issue yet. We've received a lot of submissions. Like all journals, we have problems getting reviewers who are willing to do the work and then willing to get the reviews of the papers in promptly. So there are always unavoidable delays or avoidable delays, but they're delays nonetheless. A number of the papers that we have received are under revise and resubmit. That is to say, they need more work before they can become publishable. So we've sent them back to authors with comments. One of the editor who does the most work, Francesca Minerva, got married recently, not too long ago, and is pregnant and going to be having a baby before too long. So we've had some unavoidable delays in the editorial procedures because of the personal circumstances. But we've got some papers scheduled for publication, and we've got some others under review. But I don't know how to predict when the next issue will come out. I have been pleased that we have received some papers defending, or not so much defending, but papers discussing an issue that is really highly controversial, namely pedophilia. And I'm hoping that we may have one or two or possibly even three papers on that issue in the second issue.
Do you think you learned anything from the first issue? Do you think that that issue confirms the necessity of the journal? Do you think it's encouraging, or what's your reaction to it?
Well, I thought there were a number of really good papers in the first issue. What pleased me most was that we were able to publish a paper by Alex Byrne in which he replied to some criticisms of a previously published paper of his about what the concept of a woman is, whether the notion of a woman is the notion of an adult human female. And so we published this paper, and we were published a reply to it, which was also a reply to his earlier paper by an anonymous author who's objecting to Byrne's views and defending a position that is more consistent with that which transgender activists have defended. And what's nice about that for me was that both the papers are carefully and rigorously argued pieces of analytic philosophy, and both of them are written in non-polemical, courteous, civil terms. So we've shown that it's possible to have a debate between people who are taking very different positions on a highly controversial issue and debating one another in a respectful way, concentrating on the ideas and not attacking each other.
Certainly, we could use more of that.
Yeah, what I had hoped for the journal was that we would be able to set a good example of this kind of discourse. And I think that we achieved that in the first issue, and that really pleased me a lot. That's what we're trying to do. And it was also, in a way, pleasing to me that the person defending the pro-transgender position chose to accept our offer of pseudonymity. I had thought that only people defending views that conflict with current orthodoxies would choose to write under a pseudonym. So I was pleased, in other words, that we didn't have the person expressing skepticism about certain views that transgender activists advocate. I was pleased that that person didn't choose pseudonymity, and that the person defending what in the current climate might be the less controversial position did choose pseudonymity. Don't know why that's particularly pleasing to me, but what does distinguish the journal from others is the option of pseudonymity. And people have criticized that by saying, well, these are people who are not willing to take responsibility or be accountable for their views and so on. And so I was actually pleased that someone who, on issues of substance, agrees with our critics, nevertheless did take that option.
Yeah, one thing I thought was surprising, and maybe what's pleasing is that it frustrates the expectations that some of your critics had about this, is that it's not at all predictable who would and who would not choose pseudonymity. Like, if I just read the papers and had to guess which one of these are published under pseudonyms, I would have no idea. You know, I would not have guessed the ones that were, which means that, you know, there are probably a far more diverse range of scholars who would avail themselves of this option and will possibly in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's difficult for me to talk about the papers that we've received that are still under review without giving things away, because right at the moment, I'm not sure which ones have been decisively accepted for publication. I'll just say this. We did receive another paper from a transgender person who kind of outed herself in writing this paper, saying, for example, that she thought it's not just transgender people who have the right to say things about this without offending other people, that this should be a debate open to everybody. I liked that paper a lot, too. I hope we're going to publish it. but I'm not sure at this point.
Great. Well, Professor McMahon, you have been incredibly generous with your time, and I have really enjoyed this exchange. You've given me a lot to think about, and I just appreciate having you on.
Thanks very much, Spencer. You certainly don't have to call me Professor McMahon. You can just call me Jeff. But this has been.
I guess I just started reading your papers when I was an undergrad, so it's still in my head somewhere.
Yeah, I know. It makes me feel so terribly aged when people call me that. You know, so yeah, I've always been a little averse to being called, you know, Dr. McMahon or Professor McMahon or something like that. But anyway, I've really enjoyed the discussion. We haven't ever actually met sort of image to image or face to face or whatever you might want to call it. And so I'm glad to get to have this conversation with you, having had email exchanges with you a bit in the past. So this has all been very welcome and appreciate it myself.
Likewise.